Harper Audio presents Siddhartha's Brain, Unlocking the Ancient Science of Enlightenment by James Kingsland. This is Stephen Crossley. Introduction. We are all mentally ill, said the smiling monk in the wide-brimmed hat, as if this explained everything. My partner and I were staying a couple of nights as guests at Amaravati Buddhist Monastery near Hemel Hempstead in the Chiltern Hills of southern England. I was a science journalist with the Guardian newspaper, and had travelled up by train from London the previous day to interview the abbot, a kindly Englishman in his 50s named Ajahn Amaro, who has been trained in the strict Thai forest tradition of Buddhism. The three of us stood in bright morning sunshine on a path that led between neat flower beds from the painted wooden huts of the monastery's retreat centre to a field of rough grass, where men and women were pacing very slowly and deliberately, each absorbed in a private world of his or her own. Some were walking back and forth between trees, following tracks worn in the grass by thousands of tramping feet. Others were relentlessly circling a bell-shaped granite stupa at the centre of the field. A two-week retreat for about 30 laypersons had begun the previous evening, and this morning the abbot, the monk in the sun hat, had sent them out into the grounds to practice walking meditation. His observation about our collective neurosis took me by surprise, following as it did from my own observation that the otherworldly activity in the field reminded me of a scene from a zombie movie I once saw. On reflection, it wasn't the most enlightened comment to direct to a revered Buddhist teacher or Ajahn during a meditation retreat. But I was tired and grouchy after being awakened at 4:30 in the morning by the monastery's great brass bell being struck somewhere outside in the darkness, summoning us from our dormitory to the meditation hall for an hour of chanting and contemplation. I only later discovered that in Buddhist philosophy, a human being is not considered completely sane until he or she has become fully enlightened. Buddhists believe the mechanism of the human mind is faulty, like a clock running too fast or too slow. No matter how rational or mentally fit we believe ourselves to be, much of our lives is spent obsessing about our social and professional standing, about getting sick and growing old, yearning for more of this and less of that, chewing over our faults and those of other people. Buddhists believe that our minds create dukkha, the suffering or sense of unsatisfactoriness that is part and parcel of ordinary human existence, the incessant itch of wanting more pleasure and more possessions, trying to hold on to some experiences while frantically trying to push others away. To observe that everybody is mentally ill was the monk's way of summing up this shared psychological predicament. Earlier that day, in the thin grey light before dawn, sitting cross-legged on the floor with the monks and nuns before the gilded Buddha in the monastery's meditation hall, we had chanted, "Birth is dukkha, aging is dukkha, death is dukkha, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief and despair are dukkha. Association with the disliked is dukkha. Separation from the liked is dukkha. Not attaining one's wishes is dukkha." This was a far cry from the brisk, cheerful hymns we used to sing at morning assembly in the chapel of the Methodist boarding school I attended as a child. Instead of affirming the triumph of celestial beings over evil, here was a stark reminder that all human existence is mired in suffering. The message seemed to be that no one gets to live happily ever after. Everything was not going to be okay. Regardless of the joys, loves, and achievements scattered along life's path, around every corner awaited loss, disappointment, sickness, aging, and death. There would be no escaping these things, no matter how hard we worked, how much we earned, how healthily we ate, how often we went to the gym. It was an ancient formulation of the modern refrain, "Life is a bitch, and then you die." You may find this sort of reflection needlessly maudlin, or you may see it as a bracing admission of the truth. Speaking for myself, I found the sentiment liberating. By saying the words out loud, we were acknowledging the lies we continually tell ourselves to get through the day. The down-to-earth honesty of the chant moved me. It brought a sense of reconciliation with reality. Even so, I was startled by the monk's assertion that we are all mentally ill. Surely it's one thing to suffer because of one's circumstances, loss, failure, ill health, aging, and quite another to experience an unrelenting illness such as major depression or psychosis, conditions that are always there in the shadows regardless of how well or badly things are going. Surely these illnesses fall into a different category of dukkha that is experienced only by an unfortunate few. This view is beginning to look increasingly simplistic. We have become accustomed to the idea that there are two kinds of people, those who suffer from a psychiatric illness and those with a clean bill of mental health. In reality, the picture is much more blurred. Psychiatrists are beginning to realize that traditional diagnoses such as depression, anxiety, schizophrenia, and bipolar disorder are not as clear-cut as they once believed them to be, and that symptoms used to label patients as having one illness or another are in fact widespread and exist on a continuum in the general population. Take psychosis, a condition popularly assumed to be extremely rare. It is traditionally characterized as the experience of confused, disturbing thoughts, hallucinations, and delusions such as paranoia, the unfounded belief that other people are trying to harm us. In reality, hallucinations and paranoia are much more prevalent in the general population than many realize. Research suggests that up to 30% of us will have daytime hallucinatory experiences sometime during our lives, and somewhere between 20 and 40% are regularly prey to paranoid thoughts. Even among those who have been diagnosed as having psychosis, there is an enormous amount of variation in their experience of delusions and hallucinations. It seems that what unites people with psychosis more than any other symptom is their experience of anxiety, depression, and neuroticism, all of which are commonplace among people who have never been labeled as mentally ill. Muddying the waters still further, patients with severe depression often experience the delusions and hallucinations traditionally associated with psychosis. Another example is bipolar disorder, characterized by alternating bouts of depression and elation or hyperactivity. While only 1 to 1.5% of people in Europe and the US are diagnosed as having bipolar disorder, mood swings are commonplace, and as many as 25% of us report experiencing periods of euphoria, reduced need for sleep, and racing thoughts. According to the British Psychological Society, this suggests that an all-or-nothing diagnosis for bipolar disorder is an oversimplification, as it is for psychosis, and that symptoms of the disorder exist on a continuum throughout the general population. So it seems there is a background level of psychological malaise that touches both the mentally well and the mentally ill. The formal diagnoses are just the tip of an iceberg, though the part of the iceberg showing above the water is quite bad enough. Mental health services have their work cut out even in countries such as Denmark, which for years rejoiced under the title of the happiest nation on earth, thanks to its high GDP per capita, low income inequality, personal freedoms, good nutrition, excellent public health care, long life expectancy, and other markers. Despite all their nation's blessings, a surprisingly high number of Danes require treatment for serious mental illnesses at some point, some 38% of Danish women and 32% of Danish men will receive therapy in a psychiatric hospital or clinic during their lifetime. Clearly, many others, both in Denmark and in every other country around the world, experience the symptoms of mental illness without resorting to this kind of specialist professional help. They are the silently suffering majority, the everyday mentally unwell who struggle on largely by themselves. Mental health problems start early in life. Worldwide, around 10% of children are estimated to have a diagnosable mental illness, roughly half being anxiety disorders and half a conduct disorder or ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. Many of these children will grow up unhappy. The best predictor of whether a child will become an adult who is satisfied with life is not academic achievement, sociability, or family background, but his or her emotional health during childhood. The high prevalence of psychiatric illnesses and the fact that their symptoms exist on a continuum of severity throughout the general population suggests that they are not discrete conditions like diabetes or asthma, but an extreme manifestation of the ordinary human condition. Genetics, upbringing and life events certainly play a powerful role in making some people more susceptible than others, but our shared mental endowment, the standard issue cerebral equipment, if you will, is largely to blame for all this psychological turmoil. Traditional diagnoses of mental illness capture only a fraction of our problems, and the widespread prevalence of violence, prejudice, and conflict in human society are hardly indicators of well-tuned mental machinery. What's to be done? It's not as if we haven't been trying to fix the innate weaknesses of the human mind for a very long time. Attempts to fix our wonky brains are as old as civilization. You could argue that the only common ground between the world's great religions is that they have been doing their level best for millennia to bring the wayward mind to heal. So when Ajahn Amaro asserted that we are all mentally ill, there was an even bolder subtext. Buddhism is the cure. All religions are trying to achieve the same objective in their own ways with varying degrees of success. What seems to set his apart from the others is that it aims to achieve this daunting feat without a rigid creed, set of commandments, or appeals to divine intercession. Many have argued that Buddhism is not a religion at all, at least not in the conventional sense. To an atheist and skeptic like myself, this lack of a supernatural belief system makes Buddhism very appealing. When I first became interested in its practices and philosophy some 5 years ago, I was also intrigued by the way sin, in the language of other religions, lust, gluttony, sloth, wrath, envy, pride, and so forth, is labeled more neutrally by Buddhists as unskillful behavior that will reap painful consequences through the ineluctable operation of the laws of cause and effect. The implication seems to be that to be a good, contented human being is a skill that can be learned, like driving a car or baking a cake. The more you practice, the better you will get at it. Viewed this way, to judge someone for their greed or pride starts to look as misguided as condemning them for not being able to drive or bake. Nevertheless, why should Buddhism be any better than the other world religions, or indeed a completely secular approach at teaching such skills? All things mystical and religious, regardless of whether or not they involve a god, a creed, or commandments, are viewed with suspicion by many scientists and non-believers, including the majority of those I have worked with over the years in my job as a science writer and editor. And the cure Buddhism claims to offer for the afflicted human mind is largely based on meditation, which for professional skeptics like myself looks initially like just another health fad. Mindfulness, meditation, which involves cultivating non-judgmental awareness of the present moment, has gone global. There are programs tailored for use in schools in the UK, for young offenders in New York City, for US Marines awaiting deployment, for firefighters in Florida and taxi drivers in Iran, to name just a few. But in intellectually conservative circles, announcing that you meditate is still likely to be met with a snort of derision. Claims in the past about the efficacy of meditation have been tainted with a certain amount of woo-woo New Age mumbo-jumbo. In several countries around the world, people still remember elections during the 1990s when candidates for the Natural Law Party advocated transcendental meditation as the cure for all the world's ills. The party declared that its systematic and scientifically tested program would involve thousands of meditators creating coherence in national consciousness to reduce stress and negativity in society through the power of levitation. I remember watching the party's surreal 1994 European election broadcast in the United Kingdom, which showed cross-legged young men bouncing across mattresses on their bottoms. We were informed that a group of these yogic flyers had already reduced the crime rate in Merseyside by 60% over the previous 7 years. Against this backdrop, scientists looking into the potential clinical benefits of mindfulness meditation have had to work hard over the past few decades to be taken seriously. Several researchers have told me that when they started out in the field, it was considered career suicide to admit to your peers that you were investigating meditation. This has all changed now. Some of the world's most respected clinical psychologists and neuroscientists are now involved, and their papers are published in mainstream journals such as Nature, Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, and The Lancet. The credibility of the field has been enhanced enormously through the use of new brain scanning technologies such as fMRI, functional magnetic resonance imaging, which has shown in study after study that meditation produces discernible changes in brain activity. Another remarkable development has been recent studies of the brains of Buddhist contemplatives who have clocked decades of meditation experience in various monastic traditions. This research has largely been inspired by formal discussions since the 1980s between scientists and the Dalai Lama. One of the neuroscientists most closely involved in this work is Richard Davidson from the University of Wisconsin, who says we still have much to learn from contemplatives. This research has underscored the potential value of these traditions for cultivating healthier habits of mind, he told me. Mental practice can lead to fundamental changes in the brain to support these new habits. He believes that the brain's innate plasticity, its capacity for rewiring itself as we learn from experiences and develop new skills, can be harnessed to promote well-being. According to this view, happiness is a skill that, like any other, can be developed through diligent practice. All the same, there remains a certain wariness of meditation. One common misunderstanding which inspired my cynical joke that morning at the monastery is that it transforms people into creatures who have had all their desires, ambitions, and personality excised. Zombies, if you will. When I played back the recording of my interview with Ajahn Amaro, I was relieved to discover that it was he who first brought up the subject. I had suggested to him that Buddhism, with its emphasis on cultivating selflessness, went against the grain of Western culture, with its emphasis on endless striving for self-advancement. It's what gets us out of bed in the mornings and pays our bills. He disagreed. People think that in Buddhist practice you're meant to be free from desire, and so then we shouldn't want anything. They take it to mean that we're supposed to be totally passive, or endeavouring to be a kind of zombie that isn't doing anything. It's a radical misunderstanding because A, work does not mean suffering, and B, peace does not mean inactivity. When we think, I want to be peaceful, we think of zoning out at the beach. But you can be completely at peace and working hard at the same time. They are not antithetical to each other. If anything, this book will argue that the evidence from neuroscience suggests that meditation can make people less zombie-like by giving them more control over their thoughts, emotions, and behavior. Siddhartha's brain is about the science of mindfulness and the quest for spiritual enlightenment, or, to express the same thing in less loaded terms, the search for optimum psychological well-being. Enlightenment has distinct religious overtones, though what Buddhists mean by the word is simply the full realization of the way things truly are, free of any kind of delusion. This is not so different from what scientists are trying to achieve when they investigate the chemistry, physics, and biology of our world. But what of that other slippery word, spiritual? As I have looked deeper into mindfulness and Buddhism, the dividing line between the spiritual guidance provided by teachers such as Ajahn Amaro and the mindfulness courses provided by mental health practitioners has started to look less and less clear-cut. In the past decade, thousands of studies have been published that tested the efficacy of secular forms of mindfulness meditation for treating drug addiction, depression, anxiety, and many other afflictions of the mind. Whether you believe this approach is seeking to improve people's spiritual health or their mental well-being is a matter of perspective. Your choice of words will depend on whether mindfulness training is delivered in a monastery or a clinic. Ajahn Amaro, in common with many other Buddhist teachers, sees himself as much as a mental health counselor as a spiritual advisor. Every day, people share their anxieties, their problems, and their hang-ups with him. He listens and offers advice about possible courses of action. When it comes down to it, there's not that much difference between his role and that of a secular expert in mindfulness therapy. More important, how sound is the clinical evidence for the efficacy of mindfulness? New fields of research are often characterized by great enthusiasm among practitioners, but also a lack of experimental rigor. Have the benefits of mindfulness been oversold? It wouldn't be the first time a new treatment for mental illness has been hyped by the media and those involved in its development. In 2004, I wrote a feature for New Scientist magazine about a class of antidepressants called SSRIs, including Prozac, fluoxetine, and Paxil, paroxetine, which for the past decade have been marketed as wonder drugs. They were said to make you better than well with few adverse effects. The popular myth arose that if you took these drugs, you would feel wonderful all the time. When I wrote the feature, that picture was starting to look increasingly flawed, with research coming to light suggesting that the drugs weren't nearly as effective as had been claimed and that they had serious side effects. There followed definitive studies showing that, at best, SSRIs are reasonably effective in mild to moderate depression, and at worst, they are no use at all. Will clinical applications of mindfulness live up to their early promise, or will they turn out to have been similarly hyped? Is the bubble of enthusiasm surrounding the young scientific field of mindfulness about to burst? In common with many new treatments, the preliminary investigations into mindfulness had some weaknesses, but recent research has been much more rigorous and many analyses have now been published that pool the results of several studies, involving thousands of people in total. The evidence that mindfulness therapy can prevent a relapse in patients with major depression is now very strong, for example. Clinical research into the potential worth of mindfulness programs for treating insomnia, post-traumatic stress disorder, bipolar disorder, psychosis, and many other conditions remains in its infancy. But there is good evidence for its efficacy in anxiety disorders, chronic pain, and drug addiction. Its ability to enhance cognitive performance, such as improving memory and raising IQ, is less certain because not enough high-quality research has been conducted in these areas to date, though there is solid evidence that it can sharpen attention and improve emotional regulation. What is certain is that unlike popping a pill, mindfulness is no quick and easy fix. To achieve lasting benefits almost certainly requires dedicated practice that continues beyond the standard 8 weeks of a training course. Mindfulness is a way of being from moment to moment rather than an end in itself, and Buddhists envisage it as just one, albeit essential, element of a much broader program for promoting happiness and contentment. For example, they believe that spiritual enlightenment is impossible without compassion, both for oneself and others, and ethical behavior. One of my aims in writing this book is to bring these teachings to a wider audience and investigate how well they withstand scientific scrutiny. If mindfulness works as billed, the question then becomes, why? What has gone so wrong during the evolution of the human brain that it needs to be fixed by meditation? Curiously, no one I spoke to during my research for this book had given much thought to this question. So, in Siddhartha's brain, I propose a possible solution to this puzzle based on the available evidence from anthropology, neuroscience, and genetics. There are those who dismiss any speculation about the evolution of mental and psychological traits as belonging in the realm of ideas rather than science. But the human brain and, by extension, the mind are as much a product of evolution as the eye or the kidney. So it seems odd not to attempt, using all the tools at our disposal, to explain how it developed its strange quirks. If we can then discover exactly how meditation corrects these evolutionary glitches, if indeed it does, we will then have discovered the scientific basis of enlightenment. Buddhism provides a mental toolkit for improving psychological well-being that was developed in the 5th century BCE. But neuroscientists and psychologists are only just beginning to investigate its potential for changing the brain and behavior. No longitudinal study has been published that follows the progress of people in the months, years, and decades after they start to meditate regularly. Suppose, for example, one were to track the changes in the brain of a young adult embarking on such a program from absolute beginner through to an experienced, even enlightened state many years later. What might that tell us about the potential for fine-tuning the human mind for optimal mental health and happiness? Drawing upon modern scientific evidence, this book travels back in time to envisage such a transformation as it occurs in the brain of an apparently ordinary 29-year-old man called Siddhartha Gautama, Siddhartha Gautama in Pali, who started out on this spiritual journey some 2,500 years ago. He would go on to revolutionize the way his contemporaries viewed themselves and would do more than anyone else to bring the benefits of meditation to our long-suffering species. Siddhartha's brain presents reconstructions of some of the key moments in this man's life, based on the accounts in Buddhist scriptures. "We are all mentally ill," said the abbot of Amaravati Monastery with a smile. It was an extraordinary declaration, but I knew exactly what he meant. "That's why we're here," I replied. Chapter 1. A Fool's Paradise. Our life is shaped by our mind. We become what we think. Suffering follows an evil thought as the wheels of a cart follow the oxen that draw it. The Dhammapada, translated by Eknath Iswaran, verse 1. Picture a lush grove on a still, warm evening in late spring. The throb of cicadas and the chatter of a river as it carves a path through the forested landscape are the only sounds. At the center of the grove stands an old fig tree with a broad trunk and fresh, green, heart-shaped leaves with long, tapering tips. And sitting cross-legged beneath the tree, almost hidden in the shadow cast by the setting sun, you might just make out the slight figure of a man wrapped in filthy rags. Look closer, and you can't help but notice his sunken eyes the dark caverns of his cheeks and how loosely the rags hang from his bony shoulders, though he sits bolt upright, as solid and unwavering as the ancient tree. Our story begins by the sandy banks of the Naranjara River near the village of Uruvela in northern India. The birth of Christ lies more than 400 years in the future, and the foundations of science and philosophy are still being laid by the great thinkers of ancient Greece. The emaciated Indian sitting unmoving in the darkness beneath the tree is Siddhartha Gautama, a homeless man in his mid-30s. Just a few minutes before we arrived, he was finishing a meal of rice cooked in coconut milk, scraping the last grains from the bowl. It was his first square meal in a very long time, and may well have saved him from a premature, inglorious death by starvation. Describing his predicament in later life, he would say that after years of brutal self-denial, his hair had started to fall out. His limbs looked like the jointed segments of vine stems or bamboo stems. Because of eating so little, my backside became like a camel's hoof. His ribs jutted from his chest like the crazy rafters of an old roofless barn. His eyes had sunk so deep into their sockets they were like the gleam of water deep in a well. His father, Suttotana, a wealthy and influential man, who was the elected chief or king of the Shakya clan in their remote northern republic in the foothills of the Himalayas, would have been horrified to see him in this state. 6 years previously, Prince Siddhartha was living in great comfort in the grand family home at Kapilavastu, the republic's capital, about 230 miles northwest of Uruvela near the border between what is now southern Nepal and the Indian state of Uttar Pradesh. His family were members of the governing warrior class, the Kshatriya. According to legend, when Siddhartha was a baby, 8 Brahmin priests foretold that he would become either an all-conquering ruler or he would renounce the world to fulfill a spiritual destiny. King Suttotana wasn't taking any chances with his son's future career. He spared no effort or expense to ensure that as Siddhartha grew up, he enjoyed every luxury and experienced no discomfort. Lotus pools were made for me at my father's house solely for my use. In one, blue lotuses flowered, in another white, and in another red. I used no sandalwood that was not from Benares. My turban, tunic, lower garments and cloak were all of Benares cloth. A white sunshade was held over me day and night so that I would not be troubled by cold or heat, dust or grit or dew. His father ordered the palace guards to prevent him from encountering any hint of sickness, aging, or death. The king believed that if he could only shield his son from all life's unpleasantness, he would not be drawn to the spiritual life and would instead take the worldly path and become a powerful leader. Siddhartha reached the age of 29 and everything seemed to be going according to plan. He had grown up handsome and strong, winning the hand of a beautiful young woman in the traditional manner in an archery contest. His wife had recently given birth to a healthy baby son. But, despite his father's best efforts, eventually and inevitably, Siddhartha came face to face with the realities of life. While he was out driving one morning with his charioteer in the pleasure park, they encountered a senile old man. Siddhartha asked the charioteer what was wrong with the man. "This was what happened to people the longer they lived," he explained. "Their minds and bodies steadily declined." Shortly afterward, they came across a sick man and later a corpse. In the end, there was no escaping these things. The richest, most powerful man in the world could not hold back sickness, aging, and death. It dawned on Siddhartha that sooner or later even the most beautiful and wonderful things in his life, the most sensual pleasures, would fade. Nothing would be perfect, nothing permanent. Everything he had come to love was subject to change, death, and decay. The king probably noticed a change in his son's demeanor. He seemed distracted, depressed. To cheer him up that evening, Suttatthana sent dancers and musicians to entertain him. But as Siddhartha would later recall, when he awoke on his couch in the middle of the night, the performers had all fallen asleep. The minstrels had let their instruments slip through their fingers, and the dancing girls had flopped exhausted to the floor. They were a pitiful sight. Some drivelling at the mouth, spittle besprinkled, some grinding their teeth, some snoring, some muttering in their sleep, some gaping, and some with their dress in disorder. The scene filled Siddhartha with disgust. What had been bright, sensual, and beautiful just hours before had become ugly and debased. So this is what follows in the wake of worldly pleasures, he thought. When he retired to his bedchamber and gazed upon his sleeping wife, desire died in him because all he saw was the old woman she would become. Looking down at his newborn son in his cradle and pondering the boy's future, all Siddhartha saw was a trap holding them both fast to this futile round of duty, trivial entertainments, pain, disappointment, and death. Faced with this sudden mental crisis, the solution seemed obvious. He would run away and start a new life free from the fetters of home and family. He would seek a path out of this cycle of suffering. Earlier that day, after encountering the horrors of sickness, aging, and death for the first time while riding in his chariot through the town, another strange being had caught his eye. A man sitting cross-legged on a street corner, apparently untouched by the noise and chaos all about him, radiant and serene. His charioteer told him this was a wandering ascetic, a truth-seeker, who lived in the forests and relied on the generosity of others. For Siddhartha, he was like a heavenly messenger showing him the way. While still young, a black-haired young man endowed with the blessings of youth in the first stage of life, and while my parents, unwilling, were crying with tears streaming down their faces, I shaved off my hair and beard, put on the ochre robe, and went forth from the home life into homelessness. So began his search for the incomparable peaceful state of spiritual enlightenment. Despite the passage of 2,500 years, we can empathize with the spoiled young Siddhartha's plight. Like him, many of us have been raised in a fool's paradise. Most people in the developed world have food in abundance, entertainment and pleasant distractions are just a short journey or finger tap away. Drugs and surgery give us the illusion that we can defeat disease and aging, though in reality, they simply delay and prolong old age. Until comparatively recently in human history, encounters with death were commonplace, but young people nowadays find it almost impossible to imagine that one day they too will die. Like Siddhartha, many grow up without ever having seen a dead body with their own eyes. Death is a staple of movies, television, dramas, and the news, but our own demise is a profoundly taboo topic of conversation. Perhaps we subconsciously believe that if we don't talk about it, we can somehow cheat it. For much the same reason, we are loath to talk about debilitating or fatal illnesses such as cancer. These delusions can't last, of course, but maybe they are worth sustaining for as long as possible if they allow us to live happy, fulfilled lives while we still have our health. If only it were that simple. In advanced economies, many of us have enjoyed steadily rising standards of living since the 1950s and taken advantage of increasingly sophisticated social support and healthcare systems. And yet self-reported levels of life satisfaction have scarcely budged in more than half a century. We are in the grip of what epidemiologists call the happiness paradox. Are we doing something wrong? Research suggests that, ahead of physical health, employment, and freedom from poverty, mental health is the most important determinant of individual happiness in developed countries. Unfortunately, we appear to be failing badly on this score. The World Health Organization, WHO, estimates that globally, 450 million people are experiencing a mental health or behavioral problem at any given time. 350 million of them are adults suffering from clinical depression, which makes psychiatric illness one of the leading causes of ill health and disability. Worldwide, nearly 1 million people commit suicide every year. Startling rates of psychiatric illness are seen even in the richest countries. In the UK, 1 in 4 people will face some kind of mental health crisis in the course of a year, with chronic anxiety and depression being the most common afflictions. Almost 6% of Britons over the age of 16 report that they have attempted suicide at some time in their lives. Before too long, mental illness will be putting a greater strain on the health services of rich countries than any other disease, with the WHO predicting that depression will be the biggest disease burden in high-income countries by 2030. The global cost of mental disorders in lost economic output is predicted to be $16 trillion over the next 20 years. In 2015, I attended a conference in London entitled The Global Crisis of Depression. Former UN Secretary General Kofi Annan opened the proceedings with these words: "Let's be honest, sometimes the title of a conference can overstate challenges in an understandable attempt to focus attention on a neglected issue. But that is not the case today. Calling the challenge of depression a global crisis is no exaggeration at all." In Chapter 6 of this book, Golden Slippers, I explain the role of a psychotherapy inspired by Buddhist contemplative practices known as Mindfulness-Based Cognitive Therapy, MBCT, in efforts to tackle this daunting challenge. Affluence doesn't shield us from unhappiness, though it certainly helps. There is a clear association between poverty and mental illness. The legend of Siddhartha's early life looks almost like a thought experiment conducted by his early followers as they ornamented and passed down the story to future generations. Suppose a human had everything he or she could possibly want: physical health, good food in abundance, riches, comfort, sensual pleasures, status, a family, security. Would this be sufficient to bring lasting happiness? Their conclusion was that it would not. The human psyche is inherently flawed, preventing lasting satisfaction even when circumstances seem ideal. This was a shocking discovery. Where did it all go wrong for the human mind? It is easy to fall into the trap of thinking that evolution proceeds like the design process of a series of increasingly complex motor cars, a neat, ordered progression from the equivalent of a Ford Model T to the power and sophistication of a Formula One racing car, when in fact it has been a messy and imperfect process. We're still here. Our species has thrived like no other, but there have been plenty of mishaps along the way. Evolutionary breakthroughs have their downsides. To give just a few examples relevant to human health, the vertebrate immune system evolved over the course of billions of years to protect the body from invasion by pathogens. But it can also turn against our own tissues to cause a wide range of common autoimmune diseases, including rheumatoid arthritis, multiple sclerosis, and type 1 diabetes. Cells replicate to renew tissue and repair damage, but they can also divide uncontrollably to cause cancer. People who have a single copy of a particular gene can tolerate infection with the Plasmodium parasite that causes malaria, which has been rife in sub-Saharan Africa ever since the development of agriculture thousands of years ago. But having two copies causes the excruciating and potentially fatal condition known as sickle cell anemia. Natural selection, rather than bringing us closer and closer to a state of godlike perfection, is in reality a series of awkward compromises. Adaptations may have a net benefit, but they bring disadvantages in their wake. So it has been with the evolution of the human mind. There can be no doubt that our brain, which Isaac Asimov once described as the most magnificently organized lump of matter in the known universe, is a wonderful product of natural selection, with language and creativity among its unique adaptations. And yet the statistics for mental illness suggest that it has not been crafted particularly well to provide psychological stability and lasting happiness. Natural selection weeds out genes from populations that harm an individual's ability to thrive and reproduce, and at first glance, common mental illnesses such as addiction, anxiety, and depression don't fit this universal law. Even though they have a strong genetic component and tend to reduce the number of children that patients will have compared with people who don't suffer from these conditions, they have nonetheless remained widespread in populations all around the world. This suggests that the very same genes that make some people more susceptible to common mental illnesses have also played a vital role in ensuring our survival as a species. They have conferred disadvantages as well as advantages. The exact nature of these trade-offs has yet to be established, but you don't have to look very far to find examples of the costs and benefits provided by the human central nervous system. We have built-in biological drives such as hunger, thirst, and sexual desire that are indispensable for the perpetuation of our genes. The neurotransmitters of the brain's reward system ensure that we fuel our bodies and reproduce. But this is the same system that gives us a kick from eating a huge tub of chocolate chip ice cream at one sitting, or snorting a line of cocaine. And the reward system not only keeps us coming back for more of the pleasurable substance or activity, it can also become less responsive after repeated hits, which means greater doses of the particular drug, food, or behavior are needed to achieve the same effect. Perhaps by pampering Siddhartha and providing every pleasurable distraction, his father unwittingly brought about the very destiny he was seeking to avoid for his son. In a world of plenty, the drives that help us survive in more challenging environments can become the cause of our downfall, drawing us into a cycle of craving, overindulgence, disappointment, and regret. This is the subject of Chapter 7, Fire Worshippers, which explores addiction and some promising research that suggests that meditation can be used to reduce drug cravings, helping smokers to quit, and former drug addicts to stay clean and sober. I will argue that our many mental weaknesses can be traced back to the hardwired responses that allowed our ancestors to thrive under somewhat different circumstances in our distant evolutionary past. Another example is the fight-or-flight response, a series of physiological changes orchestrated by the central nervous system that prepare our bodies for combat or to run for our lives. This will have meant the difference between life and death for an early human knocked to the ground by a hungry predator. But an alarming sensory stimulus such as sudden loud noise or being shoved on a busy underground train triggers exactly the same changes in the body. It goes without saying that punching the person who has accidentally shoved you on an overcrowded train is not going to make your life or theirs a whole lot happier. Worse still, in the long run, prolonged activation of the fight-or-flight response, otherwise known as chronic stress, is physically and psychologically harmful, putting us at greater risk of heart disease and mental illness. In the next chapter, Child's Play, I will introduce the relaxation response, which is the body's natural counterbalance to the fight-or-flight response. It is now well established that meditation is very effective at evoking this physiological response, helping people to cope with stressful situations by giving them the ability to restore their bodies at will to a less emotionally aroused state. I will provide some simple instructions you can use to start practicing this form of meditation yourself. There are several other meditations scattered throughout the book to give you a flavor of other common mindfulness techniques. Addiction and chronic stress are among the more obvious design flaws that have crept into human beings' mental blueprint in the course of our evolution, flaws that have become apparent relatively recently in our species' history. Fortunately, the brain has another inbuilt mechanism that over time can help turn down overpowering emotions such as anger and fear, which is the subject of Chapter 8, A Drunk Elephant. But the problems for the brain don't end with our primitive drives, emotions, and defense mechanisms. Some abilities that set us apart from all the other primates, including language, creativity, and the capacity to live in very